I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My guest today is Holly Tucker, Professor of French and Biomedical Ethics and Society here at Vanderbilt, and former recipient of the Chancellor's Award for Research. Holly returned this week from a summer research location in the south of France, just in time for a conversation in my office. Holly is the granddaughter of French immigrants. Her fascination with French history began very early on. Her interest focused upon French medical practices in the early modern age by the time she received her PhD from my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in 1996. I was out of there before 20 years, about 20 years before Holly. Holly was appointed assistant professor here during the same year, and she has now forged a brilliant, productive, transformative research portfolio throughout her 21 years at Vanderbilt. She is the author of so many articles and has taught thousands of students and made an impact outside of the classroom and in the classroom. But she is also the author of three critically acclaimed books. Her most recent work is City of Light, City of Poison, Magic, and the First Police Chief of Paris. Holly, it's great to have you with us today.
Thanks, it's a treat.
So, I've been reading your books, Blood Work, and now this, and this was, I said, well, I'll take this to my one-week trip in Wyoming, and of course, it was done in a day. I couldn't put down. I was looking at the Tetons, but I'd gaze up, but it's an unbelievable story. And as you say in the introduction, it's a true story. The New York Times called it the crime book for the beach. Could you kind of tell us, how did you come to this incredible historical narrative? And then as a brilliant scholar, a very erudite colleague, how did you manage to produce a work that has been recognized in the scholarly community and in the New York Times, in the New Yorker, by other publications who point out great works of scholarship and a beach book?
Well, I'm not sure about the beach book part, but I think that it's a huge compliment to get those types of reviews. In fact, when the New Yorker came out and, you know, said riveting storytelling and artful reconstruction, I will have to tell you, Nick, as an academic, I sat with the issue of the New Yorker, truly for almost a half hour, and asked my husband to pour me a huge bourbon because I really couldn't believe what I was reading.
Appropriately, a bourbon.
A bourbon, absolutely. Since he's a Southerner and we're in the South, for me, after I got tenure at Vanderbilt, and Vanderbilt's been a fantastic place to forge a career, I really felt this urge to want to continue my scholarship and work in ways that would have more than 10 people reading what I do. I first wrote this book on blood transfusion, Blood Work, A Tale of Murder and Medicine, the Scientific Revolution, because it was such a compelling story for research. There were lots of mysteries that I needed to figure out. These blood transfusions were being done in the 17th century, which I didn't know, and I certainly didn't know, even though I'm a specialist in the area, that they were animal to human. And then to figure out that there was an unsolved mystery around them, I thought, this is really too good and too interesting to put as an academic journal article. It's not that it's not worthwhile, and I have written about it in more academic context, but these are the types of stories about history that could draw readers outside of our small groups of scholars. And then I also thought about this, is this something that I'm able to write in that way? And I realized, my PhD was actually in literature, in French literature. And it occurred to me I'd spent an entire portion of my early career reading some of the greatest works of writing. And so I played around with the ideas, is this something that I could do? And I know how to do close readings of literary works, and I was able to understand that the best way to learn how to do something is to study from the masters. And so I started taking books by other people who had had great success in their writing and started taking a part in studying what that means to write that way. And I found that it gave me great pleasure to be able to go back in and reconstruct this time period for readers that I've lived in intellectually for over 20 years of my career. And that's how I went about looking at City of Light, City of Poison. It's a story about Louis XIV, the Sun King, who hires a police chief who intends to root out crime and also light Paris, because Paris was dark like every other city in Europe, and that's why we call it the City of Light, because this police chief ended up putting thousands of candle lanterns in the city within a year, and it was the first European city to be lit.
There was a point at which I was reading the book, and we were all kind of sitting around the house, and I said, now I know why it's the City of Lights.
Exactly. You know, and so there were things that helped to explain for me and to explain for other people why Paris has that reputation, among other things. And also, when I think about Paris and when I go to Paris, it's just this breathtaking city. And to go in and take a look at period documents and realize that I would have never wanted to step one foot into Paris in the 17th century, and that Louis XIV realized it was the armpit of his reign. And to get deeper into these stories and realize, wait a second, he wasn't just rooting out crime. He wasn't just lighting the city and cleaning the streets from all the mud and the muck. There was a whole cabal of poisoners and renegade priests and so-called witches who were selling their potions and wares. And the police chief starts to dig around to see what he can do about it. And then he starts to see that all of this stuff has begun to infiltrate itself into the king's palace. There's a really great story to be told. The problem was this one took 4 years to write, because the primary records were so overwhelming. It's all manuscript documents with the police chiefs.
I wanted to ask you about that. When I read the introduction, and then when I read the book, and the energy and the discipline you brought to an incredible archive of materials.
And I still feel like I haven't tapped.
Did that surprise you? Were the French always, at this time, record keepers? I mean, when you tell me they're taking their depositions and they're recorded and you're going to put them in the first person rather than... Mm-hmm. That is incredible to me that there is such a voluminous record that you encountered, and then to distill it to a narrative. How did you do
that? A colleague of mine has took a picture of me at the library. It's a specialist library in Paris, surrounded by these huge tomes, because the manuscripts were eventually bound into tomes, and the tomes measure about 4 feet tall by about 2 feet wide. And my primary corpus consisted of 30 of those volumes, not to mention that they are about 4 feet, I'm sorry, 4 feet, they felt like it sometimes, 4 inches tall. But surprisingly, I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to write this, because I had hoped to write this before I wrote Blood Work about blood transfusion.
Really? So this project was... kind of in the queue.
It was in the queue, and I was doing a lot of research in Paris, but the problem that I was finding is that some of the most important records were missing out of those manuscripts. So as Nicolas de Larigny, I call him Nick, it's just easier. Oh, I didn't even think about that, Nick. In fact, my mother read, she was a great beta reader sometimes, and she would just put boring in the comments or whatever. And I got just as a side note, since you share his name, I got a package in the mail. I was struggling about whether I could finish this book or not. And shows up at the front door here in Nashville, and it has lucky bamboo, plants of lucky bamboo. And there's a little note that says, "Hi, Holly, thank you for sharing my story with the whole world. Now get busy and finish it. Love, Nick.
That's good.
From Nicola, the police chief.
Even the chancellor wouldn't send that sort of note.
Can you just imagine if, you know, we all got, all right, this is good work, colleague. Now get busy and get it done. Love, Nick, the chancellor. But I was having a hard time because at a crucial point in the history, the story, the true story, Louis XIV was getting very concerned that Nick, the police chief, was getting too close to some of the closest people in his entourage.
Right.
And he needed those documents basically to go away.
Right.
And he asked this highly principled police chief to put them under seal. Mm-hmm. And those documents were under seal for over 30 years until Nick died. He, on the day after his death, he had already arranged his death to have a letter sent to the king along with a key to access these documents. And Louis XIV, who was the last person who was still alive at that point, he lived a very long life, asked those who knew about this affair, of the affair of the poisons, had these documents brought to the to Versailles, and he fed them one by one by one into the fireplace.
Yeah, that's one of the most dramatic scenes. And when you set the book at the start, the kind of tension and the drama of this box being transported to Louis, and then that it was of such an explosive nature that he personally was feeding these pages into the fire. It was my reaction, and then as I read the whole book, is, you know, kind of how the Sun King was vulnerable. And, you know, that even if there's a claim of absolute right to govern and the divine right of kings, that at the end of the day, there were people in court, there were people out of court, there were kind of high-low bureaucrats and who could really undermine the king. And there are a couple of points in the book where some of the people actually go after the king in public. Some of the characters, I think it was one of his mistresses, husbands, who was away.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he just goes... And it was
actually he was frequenting brothels, right?
Right.
Because the king was sleeping with his wife.
Yeah.
And so the husband is frequenting the brothels in the hopes of having his wife catch a sexually transmitted disease, so the king himself
would
also.
Oh, that's right. So the king himself. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, there's all this mostly loathing going on in the palace.
Yeah.
The king is trying at all turns to both create his legacy and also protect his legacy. And that's why he throws all of this stuff in the fire, because he wants history to forget. And so what happened, going back to where the origins of this came from and why I wrote the last book, Blood Work, before I wrote this one, I despaired. Because as soon as I figured out that those documents, the most detailed and most scandalous documents, had been destroyed, I thought, there's no... Even if I have all of those other volumes, the core of what I want to write about is gone. And it was only after I finished Blood Work and I was sort of swimming around trying to figure out what the next project was going to be on, and had worked on a couple of proposals that I pitched to my editor, and I just couldn't get this one out of my head. Then I realized and discovered that Nicolas de l'Araignée was meticulous, and he had been keeping side notes. There's always a paper trail, right?
Yeah.
So what?
Oh, there is.
And he had written both an inventory of every document that he put into these cartons under seal, and then made descriptions about what they contained, along with some quotes, sort of, you know, cliff notes, if you will, of this. And then even more helpful, so that's allowed me to write the narrative from the police chief's perspective, what his thoughts on them, these notes in the testimonies were, whether he thought they were trustworthy or not, how they linked up with other documents, as well as drafts of letters that he, summary letters that he wrote to the king and to his ministers. We no longer have the original letters, but we do have all of the drafts. And that also gave me, it gave me an indication of what Louis XIV had put in the fire, what Nicolas de Larigny thought about it, and then also even just through the types of markings that he was leaving in the margins, whether it's crossing out, drips, paper crumpled or not. Mm. You have to be really careful if you're writing nonfiction. I don't invent. But you can when you're trying to write true stories that are academically based, but using narrative and visceral detailing, I'm able to get a sense of what it would have been like for him to be writing this, right? And so basically how the physical document corresponds to the words that he was leaving, because we've all done that, right? You know, this is stupid, and they cross out things, and I can't believe this is. And so if you have that physical
mark
trace.
Mark it, tear it in half, throw it in a pile.
Right. And so that allowed me to understand his greatest moments of frustration. Yeah.
Did it surprise you that somebody from such a non-royal, non-aristocratic background, he was kind of... And he had ambition that he could make such an impact on history, kind of a bottoms up looking at this non-royal individual that you've made a pivotal character in French history. Did it surprise you, or when you teach to your students, are they surprised? Because they have such a... You know, our notions of class and status, they're trying to translate that into the Sun King. Do people of that stature shape history, and does that surprise you?
That's a really interesting question, because if you were to ask Larigny, and he makes it clear in his documents, is that he's not doing anything but supporting the monarchy, supporting his king, and trying to protect his king and trying to make his king look good. But along the way, and that was the other reason why I really wanted to tell this story from the police chief's perspective. It's not, you know, it's not first person, it's third person, but to use him as the driving narrative force, because in doing what is his job, right, I really like this guy at the beginning, and because he's so committed, he's detailed. I mean, he is the perfect sort of public servant. He wants all of the I's dotted, all of the T's crossed, and he's working toward the good of Parisians. He wants to get those streets cleaned. He ends up putting in one of the first sewers. Paris didn't have any sewers in the 17th century. He lights the city. And as he starts to get closer into this darker world, he has to make some really important moral choices about how far he's willing to go to protect his king. And for me, trying to understand how this really upright guy ends up transitioning and being present and ordering some of the most horrific types of torture. All for what I think he would understand to be the good cause.
Right.
What are the ethical shifts, changes, questions, journeys that one can take from being someone who's really upstanding to being somebody that I think we would say, I mean, I've had friends say, those tortures are really hard to read, and they are.
Oh no, they are very, very hard to read.
And the record, you know, it's what's also, when you get into the records, so they're written all in third person, states that she did not, cried, oh my God, please stop, heaven, Jesus, help me, right? So it's not done with quote marks, but the way, that's the nice thing about being in Vanderbilt with a lot of people. I ran it past some historians that I really appreciate, Dan Scharfstein, Joel Harrington, who both write also for larger audiences. Yeah. And I said, here's my primary document. Is it okay for me to turn these into first person? Like, absolutely, because there's nothing in there that you're inventing.
Right.
That adds, I think, the first person voices in the dialogue makes it even harder to read, because you can hear, I mean, I see the exclamation marks, and then I think my readers hear the exclamations.
What as I read it, I really try to avoid the worst sorts of presentism and to kind of start to think about class and gender. Mm-hmm. How did you come at the project of females and women and power or lack of power in the project and just making sure that the project wasn't, you know, kind of written for a contemporary audience, but that it didn't come across as women kind of with witchcraft and no agency and power. How did you come at the gender questions you took the project on and then when you executed it to act with integrity in your own mind about women and power and, you know, kind of the place they're put in this society and how poison becomes a tool of power across gender and used across class as well.
That's a really good question because you know, the majority of the people accused of poison and witchcraft, of course, were women. And of those, I would say that at least 75% of those women were from the lower classes.
Yeah.
And so what do you do? How do you write a story around that when, as someone who works, you know, in early modern cultural studies, who's an academic, who has opportunities to interact with all of our wonderful sociologists here, other people, you know, in contemporary studies, there are real questions to be asked, right? Were these women guilty? Was this part of some other epistemological trend in this society? Yes and yes. But is my job really to find the answers and tell people how they should read it? Or is my job to present things in such a way that leaves it open to actually where it begs discussion, right? And that's what I learned in the last book too, because there were really strong, I would say, particularly because, interestingly enough, the last book, Blood Work, was all about biomedical technical innovation.
Right.
And the ways in which a society responds, rejects, integrates from a variety of different perspectives, economic, religion, gendered, you name it. And I know where I stand. I know where my interpretation is. But that's, I think, the other part about writing books like these as someone who's in the classroom. I know that some people may disagree with me, but I don't see that my role, none of us are neutral. None of us can ever be politically neutral at all. But my job as an educator at Vanderbilt is to make sure that that I'm asking interesting questions, providing texts as praxis for my students to be able to dig through, and then let them come to conclusions and not trying to guide them to my conclusion.
Right.
Because with our students, I actually find that if I would come into the classroom with an argument that I think that they just need to swallow whole, actually I'll be coming out learning about 16. It will be humbling. And so that's another reason why I'm really enjoying marrying, if you will, the deep archival research that I do and writing to what we call trade audiences, to larger, larger print runs and doing book tours, is I get to be a teacher outside of the classroom in neat ways.
I think it has tons of resonance and integrity.
Oh, that makes me happy.
I really, because to go into these archives and then the French that you encounter in the archives is a 17th, 18th century French, right? Which is not like walking the streets of Paris today.
You know,
I just, to put that much effort into the project and then say, this is a teaching experience for me and then my students. Hmm. When I go to a bookstore, I think that's the best of the academy. It's the best of the humanist work. It's the best of trans-institutional work because it's embedded in a very deep source of material that people can argue about, but it grows out of this richness of scholarship that I think is just breathtaking. You're, you know, a modernist, or you go early modern. Mm-hmm. I don't know, how do you, you know, kind of characterize yourself? What I think is really fascinating, I mean, your work is just incredible, but how you're also working with these, and maybe I'm overreading, but these themes of science, religion, and witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of writing during the Enlightenment, you're writing mm-hmm. during, you know, what's called the Scientific Revolution, and you're coming to grips with something which is this dualism that still exists, but existed very much at the time where doing science or being pious mm-hmm. there was a complexity to it. I mean, you have these priests who are engaged in the mm-hmm. shenanigans, the conspiracies, and then in Bloodworks you have the same sort of conflict between what makes us human. Why are the dogs in here? So religion and science, and
it's a muddy mess, isn't it?
Yeah, but I found the pharma, you know, when you kind of would go through the apothecary, it was like you had a CSI to it. Like, okay, he's going to do, we didn't have mass spec, but mm-hmm. what's in here, take it to them. So I think this bridging of science and faith and almost, you know, kind of alchemy mm-hmm. is just incredible when most people want to see, oh, this is the time of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, let's just be a little careful here. History's a little messier is what you point out.
I think that we've gotten well beyond, for those of us working in these time periods, we've gotten well beyond the idea, and it's new, I would probably say over the last 25, mm-hmm. 30 years, we've gotten over the idea that there can be, and that there ever was, a radical break between science and society, even down to, we're working, I mean, when we say, you know, we're at the height of the scientific revolution, that we've increasingly saw that somebody like Robert Boyle, mm-hmm. father of chemistry, right? We would never imagine that Boyle would actually be doing experiments on the Philosopher's Stone. And when studies started coming in on, you know, some of the other things that he was working on, transmutation of metals and things, it was really uncomfortable in the history of science. Yeah. Community, because how could that be happening? These are legends who came in and sort of chucked away all of the superstition, but we're not at a point here where we can easily divide astronomy from astrology, alchemy from chemistry, right? And that's those, for me, that's, and even when I look at the modern period, I get really excited about looking at the idea of paradigm shifts, mm-hmm. right? And that they happen imperceptibly. Without us even noticing it. And one of the things I try to talk a lot to my students in my courses on early modern science and early modern medicine, it's fun to watch them laugh, right? Yeah. So pre-formationism, any genetics textbook will start with, you know, the homunculus, the little tiny guy in the head of the sperm. Yeah. It gets about 2 pages. Yeah. And then typically it's like, oh, but then we discovered DNA. Yeah. Yeah. I actually love watching my students start with that moment of laughter, going, I can't believe, really? I mean, leeches, really? They were doing this and that. And then over the course of the semester, they start to get more and more into the mindset of the time period. That's what I like to try to do, is help us to understand how this community, a given community, a given time, may be thinking in all of its contradictions, so that certain things have to make sense, such that how we, our modern worldview, could never begin to make sense to them. So that the types of questions that we can ask are always bounded by the worldview in which we're living in, which necessarily, because that controls the questions we can ask generally, that will control the types of answers that we'll get. And so what does that mean for us now in the modern period? Things that have become naturalized, that we can't think of thinking in other ways about right. certain things. There will be a time, and we see it in places like Vanderbilt and other great universities, where creative thinkers in the labs, in the humanities classrooms, in hospitals, doing sometimes the most odd projects you would never imagine, looking at new ways. I was just reading VU today, new ways of charging batteries, for example. That could have been unthinkable. Could you even imagine? But times change and creative thinking has to happen. And I love watching students be able to help to locate with me that moment. It's not one great man suddenly deciding that, oh, the heavens opened up and I get this great message. You know, William Harvey. William Harvey didn't on his own discover circulation of blood in 1638. William Harvey happened to be the right person at the right time, collecting this long trajectory that was in the making toward getting to that point. And so I'm always wondering, when I look at my colleagues who do science and medicine, what are we in the making of, right? Mm-hmm. What new questions are we going to ask? So I think that's why I like to work in this time period, because it's such a mucky mess.
You know, Holly, I've been your colleague, you know, for your whole time at Vanderbilt, and one of the other attributes of your work on books, on teaching, on graduate dissertations is what we call trans-institutional work. And people sometimes will say, well, interdisciplinary work, or we talk about trans-institutional. How, over your career, and does it come from just being a really curious, brilliant academic that you're, I want to talk to the people in genetics. I want to talk to the people in astronomy. I want to talk to the people who do hematology. I want to talk to the people who do philology. How did you make yourself such a university scholar? When did that light bulb go off? And, you know, you and I are both full professors. We're tenured. Mm-hmm. We both came through the ranks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe the freedom of having tenure. But what would you tell our junior colleagues and other people about this university and the opportunities to get mm-hmm. out of your silo? How did you do it?
I think it's a series of calculated risks that you make. I came in, my PhD was in French literary studies. I looked at one author who wrote between 1636 and 1643 or something. And it was at a time when the Academy was really not focusing that much on interdisciplinary studies. But I was at a place like Wisconsin mm-hmm. with one of the best history of science programs. Yeah. And I was working in a time period that, you know, early scientific revolution. And I thought, there's just so many things I don't know that I would just love to know. And not thinking, I mean, it didn't play out in my dissertation at all, but taking advantage of the fact that there are a lot of people who are a heck of a lot smarter than I am, who have a lot of things to teach me. And I think that's why I did become a college professor, because I'm as much a student, I know it's cliche to say this, I'm as much a student as I am a teacher. And I learned from my students, I learned from my colleagues, and to be able to sit, I mean, I still can't believe this, I counted all my fruit flies in a genetics class here. Why not? You know, why not? Yeah. You know, I just spent my leave a year and a half ago in the MPH program. Why not, right? Why not understand? It's more also for me is not ever to be able to say, well, I'm going to become a geneticist.
Right.
That ship sailed a long time ago when I barely survived my math classes in college. But nor am I going to be an epidemiologist or anything. Yeah. But I'm really interested in, again, these paradigms, the way people think and how knowledge is structured. And the only way that you can really understand that is to become a real student with all the humility, because it's really humiliating. No, it's humbling is the better word, is to be in a class where you don't know anything and you've got people in there who are 15, 20 years younger than you. Really. So I think for me is not focusing on those things that I know, but focusing on those things I know that I don't know that I really want to learn. My first book was not at all my dissertation, which was very scary to do.
I remember.
That's right. That you were provost when I got tenured. Yeah, you were.
Well, I just remember being, and then as I've gotten to know you, just that somebody took the risk. Because, you know, when you're looking at files, it's like, okay, can this person grow out of the dissertation? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you look at, and mm-hmm. you've mentored, obviously, many fine graduate students, but it's, I just remember, it's like, wow, she's going to take the risk of going totally different direction from her dissertation. And that's pretty unusual, and it worked, and that's been kind of your way of taking some risk and saying, I think I have this idea. I think I can execute it.
And why it's not see what happens with it? And at the pre-tenure level, I knew that I would forever regret not pursuing that line of thinking when I had the support and the resources of a great university. And if I failed at it, then I gave it my best. If I did it, I did a good job at it and the university wasn't ready to recognize it, I still did my best. But no matter what happened out of it, I would still have this, I mean, nobody loses these things. Once you pursue lines of thinking, that's knowledge no one can take away from you, right? And so I think that for me is sort of it's a balanced game of risk taking and just knowing that I don't know any better.
Well, I would say the two things that I think are profoundly important are, number one, we are all coming to school every day to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think we as professors are certainly privileged to be able to say, well, it's kind of our role to do a syllabus and stand up in the class. But most of us are really frank about coming into work and so often saying, I did not know that. Mm-hmm. And saying that that's the day I say I know all that. I've written every piece of scholarship that I want. I've read every book. I've gone through every archive. That's the time, I mean, really shut it down.
Do you know, I had that experience in graduate courses. I used to be sort of the go-to person for our graduate methodology and literary theory class. Mm-hmm. And I loved it at first. I taught it for several years and I adored it. And, you know, when you get these really bright graduate students digging around critical literary theory, really abstract stuff, Derrida for crying out loud, and Claude Lévi-Strauss, and then all this post-structuralism and stuff. And it used to get me, it still does, but in the classroom, I got so excited. And there was one day with a bright group of graduate students, and they were just diving into it with the most delight and energy. And I knew that I had to stop teaching this course when I'm listening. And I was like, yeah, okay, so when I get home, let's see. Yeah, I need to get that laundry stored and started. And then I wonder if my daughter's put the dog out yet.
Yeah.
That's when you stop and you say, okay, now you're not serving anybody at that point.
Yeah.
So I pass the course off to a colleague who teaches it more brilliantly than I do. And so with each book project too, I think that's also why I decided with blood work is to move from an academic press to W.W. Norton, one of the best presses in the United States. That wasn't anything that wasn't my end goal. I just want to see what will happen and then always be delighted by the results, because if you don't expect it and then it happens, all you can just do is just be giddy, delighted, and surprised.
Yeah, the other thing that I think the other point I wanted to reinforce is, you know, we do so much and so often appropriately, it'll be, well, there's a new cancer drug that was just discovered, or there's a new material that is superconducting. And I think when I read your work, you have discovered things. And you have created new knowledge, and that new knowledge moves forward the project of understanding who we all are. And, you know, I think these sorts of projects are as important for a great university as, you know, all the other great stuff that happens here in science and engineering. Mm-hmm. But this, to me, is a profound contribution to new knowledge for the specialist, but also for so many other readers, mm-hmm. whether at the beach or whether they're somewhere else. So let's back up also to ask about, you just kind of glanced over the, well, yeah, I did go back and get a master's in public health.
No, I haven't done it.
Are you doing it now?
I took the first year of the coursework.
Yeah.
And then for some family issues, I was on leave following that. So the year that I spent during my leave, I took, now you can talk to the professors, took epidemiology, kicked my butt. But in biostatistics, that went okay.
Cool.
Healthcare surveillance and things. So for me, it just seemed like something, having an opportunity to interact with colleagues at the medical school, which I've been doing for a while.
Right.
A little less now this year because I've been so busy with the book and other things. I just really wanted to get a sense of how our colleagues thought. And so I got to spend time with a bunch of younger doctors, listening to how they go about their research methodology, which it's a very different way mm-hmm. to approach knowledge and knowledge making than mm-hmm. how I approach it. So I don't know what the question was, but I thought I was crazy.
No, I mean, I think it just shows to me your passion and intellectual curiosity about how do I equip myself to be a better teacher? How to understand my work better, to go down paths unexplored in the next project that I have. This book to me is also just exhibit, 200 million of why writing great history is so important. We don't know who we are until we know where we were. And this project of, just opening up people's eyes and minds to what was Paris like, and how is this Sun King trying to build his legacy, and, mm-hmm. What is a society that's trying to operate in a rule of law way with predictability, but with an absolute monarchy, mm-hmm. how is that process really negotiated? And then mm-hmm. how does faith and science interact with, pretty strong beliefs in alchemy and witchcraft and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. potions and things like that? What else is on the agenda, Holly? I mean, what, there must be 10 other projects knocking around, or can you give us a little bit of a,
well,
preview on what's on your
that's
mind?
That's always the question that makes people nervous, because, really, can't I just take a break?
Well, I'm just waiting for the next one. I'm so hurt.
Well, you know what? So I spent this last summer in France. I'm working on two different projects. I tend to keep them a little closer to the chest until I have a sense about where they're shaping and where they're going. But what I will say, I have two projects in the works right now. One is requiring me to spend a fair bit of time in archives in Marseille, mm-hmm. and particularly looking at Marseille because I thought, okay, I just need to get out of Paris for a while. and Marseille, of course, in the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries, was and still is a major port.
Sure.
And so there's a lot of shipping. There are a lot of economic aspects and also very human aspects coming out of that port that will have direct impact on how the south of France developed mm-hmm. in the 17th century, as well as, of course, it's not just economic, but it's also religious, because you have a fair amount of religious conflict that looks an awful lot like the legacies of the Crusades that get transformed then into the economics. So I'm digging through the archives right now, trying to find the story. I think there's something there. That's mm-hmm. that's where my research always starts, is I think there's something there. I don't know what I'll find. And there's another project that I'm working on right now. It has more to do with Paris, and it's questions of early collecting. You know, what people find, what they do with it, and how objects end up carrying century-long meaning. And there I'm closer to the main historical figures that I want to be working with. Is there enough of a story? I don't know. I mean, before, between Blood Work and then City of Light, City of Poison, I actually spent a summer working on the guillotine. Thinking there's got to be a really great story there, and there are really great stories, and you know, there's stories of the French Revolution, and then I looked at it and I couldn't find a consistent narrative thread, and then after a while I thought, do I really want to spend the next 4 years working with the heads chopped off? No, not really. So I do work on goals, though. My next goal is to get something that looks like a clear draft of the next book by in the next 16 months, because it may be a crummy draft, but at least I'll know where I'm going.
Well, you're a true scholar, because usually when you ask a brilliant scholar writer, what's your next project, they start to feel guilty, or I don't really want to talk about it yet because I've got to execute it. So I apologize for taking you down that, but I kind of wanted to start thinking when my next favorite book would come out. And
well, I can promise you,
Professor Tucker,
I'm really structured in my writing. I write 500 words a day, even if I don't know what I'm writing about. And then I always sit with primary documents for at least a half hour every day.
That's great.
And so, then invariably something has to come from it. Because if you don't show up, nothing happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Holly, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts and certainly the products of your brilliant intellectual pursuits with the Vanderbilt community and across the globe. We have a lot of Zeppos Report fans, and I'm sure they'll enjoy this. You can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report. vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Thanks a lot, Holly.
Thanks, Nick.